Support for the National Writers Series comes from Jonathan and Marissa Wege, supporting good things that need to happen now.
Welcome to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Terry Jones has written four novels, including Silver Sparrow and The Untelling. Her latest book, An American Marriage, is a love story challenged by racial injustice. Tayari talks this hour with fellow writer Aaron Stander, author of 10 crime novels and host of Interlochen Public Radio's Michigan Writers on the Air. Tayari starts by telling Aaron why she prefers writing her books on a typewriter.
I love composing on a manual typewriter. I like how much effort it takes. I feel like when I use a computer, I'm typing so fast that I don't know what I'm typing. When I use a computer, it feels like it does when you eat too fast. Like, your plate is empty, so obviously you ate it, but you don't really remember eating it. So the typewriter slows me down. I also love making all that noise on the typewriter. Mm-hmm. You feel like you're getting something done mm-hmm. when you're making all that noise. But this book took me 6 years to write because I had a hard time finding the story that I needed. I had been awarded a fellowship to Harvard, the Radcliffe Institute, to research the subject of mass incarceration. And I did a lot of research on the topic, and I was outraged, I was angry. I learned statistics that'll keep you up at night. One that I can't quite get out of my mind is that one in 28 children in the United States has a parent in prison. And I would think about these things all the time, but I'm a storyteller, and I didn't have a story. I've always thought that you should write about people and their problems, not problems and their people. And I had a problem, but I didn't have people. And I didn't know what I was going to do about it. Just imagine the clock is ticking. At the Radcliffe Institute, we have to give a presentation of our work. And I had been working, but I didn't have any work to show. So I went home to Atlanta to visit my mother, as I do when I'm upset. And I also went to the mall, as I do when I'm upset. And while I was in the mall, I went to the food court for a little snack, as I do when I'm upset. And while I was there, I saw a young couple. The woman was really beautifully dressed, and the man she was with, he looked okay, but she looked fine. She looked just gorgeous, you know what I mean? And he looked okay. And like, you know, the old people, I don't know if old people still say this, when I was coming up, the old people would say they were unequally yoked. Do people say that up north? But I noticed them, and she did not look like the kind of woman to be arguing with her man in the food court. But it could happen to anyone. I was not judging. Trust me, I was not. I know it happens. But she said to him, "Roy, you know you wouldn't have waited on me for 7 years." And I looked, and I felt like he knew it, she knew it, and I knew it, that he probably would not have waited on her for 7 years. We knew this. But he turned and looked at her, and he said, "I don't know what you're talking about. This wouldn't have happened to you in the first place." And again, I felt we all three knew that he was probably right. And I know I have a novel when I have a situation where the characters are both right, yet they don't agree. And that's when I got the idea to write a novel about a young couple separated by his wrongful incarceration.
So it centers on these two main characters, and then there are a number of other characters, but these two main characters, I just wondered how, it's like casting a play. You make them such complete characters, and in the course of the book, you keep coming back to them. So we see the world through her eyes, through his eyes, through the eyes of a third party. And I was wondering how you compose that. I mean, it seems to me logistically such a difficult task.
Well, part of what took me so long to write the book is that I couldn't make a decision about point of view. When I wrote the novel the first time, I wrote it all from the wife's position. I was very interested in the collateral effects of incarceration and also the demands made of women under these circumstances. And so I wrote the novel, I wrote it all the way through, but it didn't feel entirely complete. I felt like there was a big part of the story that I couldn't get at just from her point of view. And I thought that maybe I should add his voice, but I resisted it a bit because I felt like so many stories are consumed with that dominant male point of view, and it kind of went against my project, but I felt that I couldn't tell the whole story unless I told it intersectionally. So then I rewrote the whole book from his point of view. And you would think that it would be harder writing a male point of view, and I'm a woman, but I wrote it so easily, and I realized that I wrote it so easily just for what I said. It was a story that I already knew. One man versus a system, and all he wants is to come home, is to come home to like a virtuous woman and a clean house. Mm-hmm. And well, the reason it seems so familiar is that this is not only a mainstay of African-American literature, but if you think about it, isn't that what the Odyssey is about? Mm-hmm. It's what the Odyssey is about. Mm-hmm. And the Odyssey was written in 70 BC. Mm-hmm. So I realized that I had a character who, in the present day, has the same desires as a man from 70 BC. And so I decided that I would toggle their two voices. And I felt like the story was getting closer, but it wasn't quite done, because I think with Roy being a black man, wrongfully incarcerated for a sexual assault, he was feeling too symbolic. Like, I felt the way I was writing it, it felt like the novel was suggesting that despite your education, despite your best intentions, you will end up in prison. And he was standing in for capital the black man. And when you start thinking of characters symbolically, they start getting flat. You can't help it. And so it's just like in real life. I'm sure we've all been in a situation where you felt like you were representing more than yourself. Maybe you were the only woman in the room, the only black person, the only person from your family. I mean, that also, even though family is a small thing, when you feel you're representing your family, you feel you have to be on your best behavior. And I felt like the characters were acting that way. But once I added the second male voice, Andre, I felt that Andre gave Roy room to be himself, and Roy gave Andre room to be himself. And once I had the three, I felt like, oh, here's this novel. It feels whole to me.
So I counted pages and chapters, and I was trying to figure out which voice had the most. And you say that actually all three characters are represented at about the same level.
Well, Roy and Celestial have the same amount, and Andre has fewer.
Okay.
But Roy's chapters feel like they take up more space because his challenge is so great.
Yeah.
And so that was a problem in balancing the novel that I felt ended up being a conflict in the novel. Just as for Celestial, Roy's challenges are so great that it tilts all playing fields toward his needs. I felt like it was happening in the actual book itself. And the challenges she faced as a character were the same challenges I faced as a writer. When I was working on this book, I would have my early readers, my friends who read for me, and everyone was getting kind of upset by the conceit of the novel, that it was a novel in which Roy is wrongfully incarcerated, but it's about more than that thing. And just as Roy gets kind of frustrated when anyone thinks about the book as more than that thing, readers were. So I was really I felt kind of hamstrung by it, but then I decided to like lean into it and help me empathize with the characters.
How did it happen, or how did it come to you to do that 50 pages of letters to and from prison? That's such an important part of the book.
Well, I write letters. I write letters in real life.
I've run into that in some of your background material.
I write letters all the time.
And people don't write you back.
Nobody writes me back.
Yeah.
Like my own mother. I write my mother a letter every Sunday. I wrote her a letter this morning. I send her the letter on Sunday. On Thursday, she texts me and says, got your letter.
Thank you very much.
But I like letters, and I have always been drawn to epistolary novels. You know, mm-hmm. ever since I read The Color Purple when I was in high school, I'm drawn to the epistolary novel. But I'm such a contemporary novelist that it's very rare that you have an occasion to put letters in a novel in such a way that it doesn't seem like you're looking for a reason to put letters in a novel. But prisoners, people in prison, letters are so important to them. So that's also part of it. Like the first time I received a letter from a prisoner was right after I'd written my first book. There's a little kind of writerly joke that we always say that once your photograph appears in Essence magazine, 6 weeks later, you'll receive letters from prisoners. And so I got my first letter and I didn't know what to do with it. And I was speaking to the poet, Nikki Giovanni. I said, Nikki, you know, I got this letter from these guys in prison. And she said, oh, you were in Essence? And I said, as a matter of fact, I was. But she said to me that whenever you receive a letter from a person in prison, you must write him back because you can't even begin to comprehend how difficult it was for him to send that letter. He has to buy the paper, he has to buy the envelope, he has to buy the stamp. And when you see the letters, they're very often written from margin to margin so as not to waste any paper. Mm-hmm. So having had that experience, I think that helped me decide to put letters in the middle. But the other reason I decided to cover Roy's time in prison in letters is that when you read a novel, you experience vicariously what the characters experience. Prison is brutality. I did not want, as a writer, to spend that much time experiencing brutality. I didn't want you, as a reader, to have to experience brutality. So using the letters, Roy is performing a kindness to Celestial by curating his experiences, yet you can still see the emotional effect of prison without kind of the blow-by-blow. So I felt like it served two purposes. And also, the letters show you literally what a small canvas they have to try to make a relationship. They're trying to make a relationship out of paper. They haven't even been married 2 years. So they have only had their paper anniversary, and now they're trying to make their relationship with paper.
It's interesting the tension that grows in those letters and fades, the affection that may be fading in a way, the length of the letters changes. They're just beautiful, subtle things that you've... How did you work yourself through those?
I don't know. I mean, I felt when I wrote the letters, I really... When I'm sitting down writing, I try to make Tiari, myself, disappear and allow the characters to behave organically. I try not to send them where I want them to go. I try to let them lead me. And the letter is just becoming shorter and shorter. Particularly, she's busy. I mean, what's happening in their relationship is that her life is moving forward and his is not. And the letters mean so much more to him. It can't be avoided. I recently reviewed the prison letters of Nelson Mandela for the New York Times. And even in reading the great Nelson Mandela, in his letters, I could see how desperately he was holding on, to the letters he received and how much they meant to him. And he's writing to Winnie Mandela, and she is this is an understatement, I almost said she's busy. I don't even think that begins to say what she was doing. He's Nelson Mandela, and he's saying, I didn't receive a letter from you this week. He felt like a man who was longing. But one of the other things in Mandela's letter is that I saw the way he was viewing, the way that he held on was to idealize Winnie Mandela and to think he would write things like, I remember you always as the girl I knew. And, she's a grown woman. She's a freedom fighter in her own right. She's doing all of these things. But the way he holds on is to remember her as a girl. And I think that also happened to Roy. I think the way he held on was to imagine her as a kind of ideal, kind of like Penelope in the Odyssey. That's how he held on. Mm-hmm. So he has to keep writing letters to keep his fantasy understanding of her alive.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up, Tiari Jones talks about how she finally finished writing An American Marriage after struggling with it for 6 years.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton, founder of the year-long book festival held in the City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. Let's return to Aaron Stander's conversation with novelist Tiari Jones.
So another important item in the book is her art, which becomes a metaphor for, I think, a lot of things. Should we talk about fabric art or folk art or fine art?
She's a doll maker. I was originally motivated to write about a doll maker. I have a friend who is a doll maker, and the amount of work that goes into making these kind of fine art dolls is unbelievable. Like, she would have to wear these special magnifying glasses to sew these things, and then when she makes them, people act like she's made a toy for little girls. And I think that is a way of thinking about the way women's art is perceived and consumed. Like, it's some girly thing you're doing. Like, often I'll be on a plane and I'll meet a man and he'll ask me, you know, what do you do? And I'll say, I'm a writer. And he says, oh, you've written a book? I'll buy it for my wife. And he doesn't mean to be offensive. He thinks that I'm supposed to understand that what I'm doing has nothing to do with him. Mm-hmm. And I felt like with the dolls, that kind of dynamic is more at the forefront. But what I've learned, that when someone says that, oh, I'll buy it for my wife, I think, you know, I'm happy that your wife will read this book, instead of concentrating on what he's perceiving of my book. Instead, think about the person who actually will read it.
So Roy's in prison, and you throw a real curveball while he's in prison. You bring in this other character, Walter.
We need to poll the audience. How many people here have not read the book? I don't know what you're talking about.
Come on, Eric, you're
I withdraw the question. Well, let's talk about something that's a little bit... There are a lot of writing students in the audience. You have a variety of characters. To an amazing degree, you give each one of them their own dialect, their idiolect, their language. You play with idiom. You know, I would read this stuff and I would just stop and try to figure out how you did this, because it was so magical. To create all of these voices, people from different generations, from different social classes, and they all came up as absolutely authentic. How does that happen? How do you make that happen?
Well, I listen to people a lot, but also I'm a good mimic. I can imitate people's voices verbally, and I'm not doing it. I told you I wasn't going to do that. But I think it's partly the same skill, in listening to all the subtle ways that people speak and the idiom they use. Like, I can very often guess where people are from. They'll give it away with like one word, and because I'm interested in
and
that.
And those one words are everywhere. I mean, that's what knocked me over.
But it was also fun spending so much time with the characters, especially generationally. This is a sidebar, hear me out. I think that this novel is as much about generation gap as anything else. When I wanted to be a writer, I told my parents that I was going to go to school for creative writing. My parents are both, they're both PhDs, but then the social scientists. They're serious people. And I said I wanted to go to school I wanted to quit what I was doing and go to school for creative writing. And my daddy said, why? And my mother said, why? And I explained that I was not challenged, I didn't feel fulfilled in what I was doing, and my daddy said, you know what your problem is? He said, you never had to pick cotton. He said, when you pick cotton, you don't go out there and say, am I challenged by the cotton? He said, you don't hold that sack and say, these cotton plants are not recognizing my complexity, this is not my niche. He said, you just go out there and pick the damn cotton. And I realized that the very thing about me that was so frustrating to him was his great gift to me. That the sacrifices his generation made, the literal cotton that he picked, made it possible for me from this generation to feel that I want to be fulfilled, I want to be challenged, I want to find my niche. That this is exactly what he wanted for me, although it was really frustrating. And I think that is at the heart of this book, right? Celestial, the expectations of marriage. You know, she wants to be fulfilled, she wants to be happy, she wants to find her niche. Like she and her family, generationally, everyone's like, you need to pick the cotton. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think is this book is about. And part of the way that I kind of get at it is through the different ways that the people of the generations express themselves. They have a different idiom because they're used to dealing with a different range of challenges.
Well, father, Roy Sr., Roy's father, is certainly that character. He's the kind of person that you want to sit and drink a glass of whiskey with.
I liked him. I enjoyed writing him.
Is he your favorite character in the book?
He's not my favorite character because he is, I like him a lot, but he doesn't show up very much because he's so sure of what he feels and what he believes. And characters are interesting when they're conflicted. He's not conflicted. He knows what he wants. He wants his family to be safe. He wants his son to be safe. He's a real charmer, and I enjoyed him, but he wasn't a character that challenged. The characters I like best are the characters that challenge me.
Like?
I think Roy's cellmate, Walter, he's challenging.
We can't talk about Walter, I'm sorry.
We can talk about him, you just can't.
Talk about him, yeah.
The thing, you can't say
yeah,
the thing.
Yeah.
But he is a challenging person because he asks the question of, can there be redemption? And how does that work? And I'm partial to Celestial, I'm partial to Andre. I like them all, but I like them best when they are unsure because as they try to find clarity, then I have to try to find clarity. So by struggling with them, I feel that I as a person am improved.
In this world with so much social media and email, readers read books and they write letters to authors. And they sometimes tell the authors they don't like the ending. Or they would do it a different way. Has that happened to you?
I'm like, so what are you trying to say? Like, what was that?
Has anyone told you they'd write the ending differently?
Then I heard somebody amening out there. I don't know who said it, but I heard you, whoever you are. I do find, you know, I feel that there's something that I like to call the tyranny of genre expectation. And I found that throughout the whole process of writing this book, that because this story is on some level a love triangle, right? Mm. We have two men in love with the same woman. People sometimes think then that the resolution of the book is who gets the girl, and that I am going to reward a character by giving them the girl as though she's a transferable object. And so part of what I'm really doing is trying to challenge that idea. And so when the book doesn't follow what some people think are the rules, it is disconcerting. Mm-hmm. They say controversy comes from discomfort and from surprise. And I think that that's what happens. So sometimes people do write to me and they give me their opinion on what they think should happen. And I just thank them for reading the book.
Mm-hmm. I have to remember that.
Yeah, just thank them. Because they read the book and they cared enough to write to you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, just write them back. But I don't argue with them about it. I mean, that's, everyone has how they would like to see it. But the end of a book isn't what you, like, I don't think of myself as handing out the goodies for the characters. And I don't like to, and also I don't like to judge the characters, and I don't like to use the events of the story to punish the characters. Mm-hmm. I feel like all these characters are in a situation that they're making decisions they never should have had to make. And sometimes I feel that maybe with Roy's voice being so clear that the story is sometimes read, like, it's easy to read all the characters as Roy reads them, and I really was trying to give them all a voice and all evidence that they all were trying to, everyone here is trying to balance their desires with their responsibilities. And I think that when you have a woman looking at her desires and responsibilities as equal, it is also disconcerting.
Well, it's interesting because we're only looking at, 300 pages. But these characters grow and change so much over that time. And I think that you, when you read it carefully, you just see that kind of evolution. which I think is hard to create. You have a list of pre-readers or people who helped you at the end of the book. It's a long list. So you had a lot of feedback. Was that how you maneuvered through this whole problem, or?
The last year and a half, I didn't show anyone else the book. I decided that I had to figure out for myself what I wanted this book to be about. And I was stranded 50 pages from the end for a year. It was awful. It was as though me and this book were in a relationship and we couldn't afford to move out. It was on the couch. It wasn't speaking to me. I was looking at it every day. It was a real problem. I couldn't bring any other books home. It was such a problem. And I realized, though, that the reason I couldn't finish the book is that I was letting Roy tell me what the book is about. Roy thinks this book is about how he can regain what he's lost. And he thinks that what he's lost is his job, his car, his woman, his status. But what he has really lost is his citizenship in his own life. And we measure our citizenship by what we can give. And he had forgotten that he's in a situation where he can give, where he should give. Because he just had suffered so much that he just forgot that part of life. His dad tries to tell him by saying, you know, you have to tell me when you're coming home. Mm-hmm. He completely forgot that other people might be worried about him because he's so busy trying to heal himself and get the other people around him to heal him. And he forgot that he is a human being with things to offer the people around him. And once he realizes that, then he can move forward in his life. And once I realized that, I was so excited. I came home, the book was on the couch, and I basically told Roy, I have figured out the problem with the book. You got to do something for someone else. And I felt like Roy, the character, resisted me. I think Roy was like, no, I don't have to do anything. I've been through so much. And I was like, no, if you don't do this, we can't finish this book. And I felt like he hung out there. He was mad at me for a while. And I was thinking, I'm going to have to return the money to the publisher. So I was like, no more brunch, you know, no more Uber, no more mimosa, but we have to save this money because I can't figure out the right ending. And I would rather not publish a book than publish a wrong book. Mm-hmm. But then I sat down, I rolled some paper in my typewriter, and I said, I'm just going to give it a try with this new understanding. And I just started typing away, and then it's just like I started typing faster, and I finished the book in about 2 days. I had to buy a new ribbon for my typewriter.
That might have been the biggest challenge in the finding a ribbon, right?
No, I have an excellent typewriter doctor.
So, 6 years.
6 years. It was 4 years overdue. I kept saying, I need 3 more months. I need 3 more months. And they just kept extending it because I published with Algonquin Books, an independent publisher. And my publisher at Algonquin, she says, no book before its time. You'll get that book right when the book is right.
That's amazing.
Yeah, they're a really terrific publisher.
So what are you going to do now?
I'm going to write another book. I do one thing.
You also teach creative writing to graduate students.
I do.
How does being a working writer influence what you do with your students in classrooms? How does one inform the other?
Well, I do feel like my students keep me honest. Every one of my novels, I've had some incredible hurdle to cross before I could publish it.
We're talking about how many years?
How many years I've been teaching?
No, the novels and the teaching has gone on with all the novels. So
right, I've been teaching. I mean, I took my first teaching job in 2002 and I published my first book that same year.
Okay.
I've always taught. But like with my novel Before an American Marriage, it's called Silver Sparrow, it almost didn't get published. There's this computer program called BookScan. You know BookScan. Mm-hmm. I hate BookScan. Okay, BookScan is this thing where they can put your name in the computer and it tells them how many books you sold. Before BookScan, as you know, you usually could act successful and they would think you were successful. But now with BookScan, they can put your name in the computer. They have it on their phones now. I met someone with BookScan on their phone. So if they meet you at a cocktail party, they just like dip behind the curtain and look at your BookScan. So my BookScan was bad. Well, it wasn't bad, but it wasn't great. And so my publisher cut me loose. My first publisher, they cut me loose. They were not interested in me. And then they took my existing books out of print. So it was like one day someone made a decision to take my entire career from me. And I didn't even know it was coming. And I didn't know what I was going to do. And the book was 3/4 of the way done when they informed me that they weren't interested in me anymore. And it really was my students that kept me writing, because I always tell my students, you write the book not because you think you can publish it. You write the book because you think it's the book that needs to be written. So how could I face them every day if I was going to put aside my book because of some computer program called BookScan? So I finished the book, and I am a person that believes that with art, when you do your part, the universe will meet you halfway. So I finished the book, and I put it in a drawer. I thought it wasn't going to be published because of the BookScan. I went to a writing conference, and it was the last reading I was invited to do, and I got there, and I was embarrassed because I thought I wouldn't have any books to sign, and because I was out of print. But I went anyway because I felt that if I had canceled, it would penalize the people who came after me. So I went, and I got to the thing, and the bookseller had 4 copies of my books, 2 of each one, and I said, oh my goodness, where did you get these? In the bookseller. So they came in this box, and I looked at the box, and there was my father's distinctive handwriting. He said, I sent my copies, and then I went over to your uncle. You know, he hadn't even touched them. Those were new. And so then Daddy said, you just sign those books, baby, and then if someone asks you, you say, oh my, I think I've sold out. So I gave my reading, I sat down, I signed my 4 copies, and a woman came up to me and she said she wanted a book. And I said, oh my, I've sold out. And she said, really? Because I heard your books are out of print. I heard that because of your book scan, you can't get a book contract. And I was so embarrassed because I thought that I had, you know, hidden this. And I was so embarrassed. I just wanted to cry. I didn't know what to do. But the lady said, I think I could help you. And you know, when you're on book tour, you meet some strange people. You don't know what that person is suggesting. But she was older than me, so I said, yes, ma'am. And she took me by the hand, and she took me through the crowd, and she put my hand in the hand of Elizabeth Charlotte, who's the publisher of Algonquin Books. And I was worried because I knew about the book scan, and I just wanted to get away. But Elizabeth Charlotte held my hand, and she wouldn't let me go. And she said, what's your book about? And I said, oh, it's about 2 girls, they have the same dad, but only one knows he has a secret family. She said, well, you should send it to me. But I didn't even want to because I was so worried. And I was trying to get away from her. She said, but don't go. Tell me, how do you know Judy? And I said, oh, I don't know anyone named Judy. And she said, no, Judy Blume, who just introduced us. It was as though my nerdy childhood had come to rescue me in my time of need. And then after that, I mean, like 3 days later, I had a book contract, and it was like the bad things never happened, which is part of why when it came time to write An American Marriage, I wanted to write a novel for the first time that was outside of my autobiography, because I felt like my career had been given back to me for a reason. And what was I going to write the next book about? I felt like I needed to try to, you know, move the needle in some way, because, I mean, I had been given this opportunity.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up, more of Aaron Stander's conversation with Tyeri Jones. Support for this broadcast provided in part by Becky Thatcher Designs, where you find jewelry to commemorate the landmarks in your life, at their stores in Leland, Harbor Springs, Glen Arbor, and Traverse City, and on the web at BeckyThatcherDesigns.com.
You're listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Let's return to Aaron Stander's conversation with Tayari Jones, whose latest novel is An American Marriage.
So, can we go back to how teaching informs writing?
Look at you. Yes.
Or should we just move
Look
forward?
Look at this one. I mean, when you're talking
I'm going to go back to Waller if you don't cooperate.
If you talk about writing all the time, it helps you write, if you're talking about it. If you like teaching, I think people who don't like teaching, it hurts their writing. Whenever you're doing something you don't want to do, it hurts your writing. But I enjoy teaching. My parents are both professors, so I'm kind of in the family business. I just love my students. I mean, I love the teachers that I had. The first time I met a writer, I was a student at Spelman College. I met a writer, and she was my teacher. And she demonstrated to me what it was to be a working writer. And so I so treasured that relationship. And I never had a feeling that as her student, I was somehow, you know, cramping her style as a writer. So I came to understand that that was just integrated into part of being a writer, was mentoring young people.
So we've talked about publishing and the problems. You're on, what, day 15 of this tour?
I've been on tour since February 6th. And I do it all with a carry-on bag.
Should I tell him how much that weighs?
Do not listen to him. It is light as a feather.
So then how many more days?
I'm on the road until after November 19th. I get to take the holidays off, and then I'll start back up on January 7th.
So this is just part of the writing life. This is what it means to be a commercial writer. I don't mean by commercial, but this is what publishers expect.
Actually, I feel really fortunate to be given this big of a tour. Most people don't get to go anywhere with their books. Nowadays, they're telling people just tweet about it. So
yeah.
I feel very fortunate to be able to meet so many, to go out and meet so many people. But I am eager to kind of go back home and sit down and start to write again, because when you're on tour, you're so invested in the past book that it's hard to get your mind into a new book.
So the new book, what is it? Where is it? Do you know yet?
I just published this one. Didn't I say I want to get home and start a new book?
Well, I'm just used to this question because I finish a book and a week
later... And do you like it? No, you don't.
So let's go back to Walter.
Oh, for real? Well, I will say this about Walter. I am a person who enjoys a novel with a lot of plot. I think it's because I read a lot of mysteries, and I like a novel that moves. I think that we make a mistake in thinking that writing that's serious is also sleepy. I feel like novels should reflect real life, and real life is full of twists and unexpected things.
And that is absolutely unexpected, but a very...
I didn't know that was coming either, actually. When that was revealed, I was as shocked as Roy. I was like, get out.
So you just woke up one morning and Walter...
Easy.
You were sitting at your manual typewriter and Walter jumped out of the...
Do you feel like he's mocking my typewriters? I was just typing away and... I don't know, it just, sometimes an idea, like I get in the zone. I like to have the same feeling of breathless anticipation as a writer that I want you to have as a reader. So therefore, I don't outline, I don't know what's gonna happen. I write to find the story. And also, I write every novel to ask myself some kind of question. So I was very curious as to, when I was working on this, about the way people make, how situation can make relationships and family. And so since I was wondering about that, I think that particular super exciting, juicy, shocking plot twist revealed itself to me in that way.
Your characters are so complete, and as I was reading it, I was wondering if you did character sketches before, or that it just comes out in the course of writing
the
book?
Also, I rewrite the book so many times. So I write the book from beginning to end. Then I write it again. And so when I come back to the beginning, after having written it all the way through, I know new things about the person. It's just like in real life, when you meet someone, you have an initial impression, and you know a little bit about them, you draw clues from what you see, but after you've known them a while, you can think back to the first day you met them and see things differently. But with a book, you have the opportunity to then shade it in. So I just keep writing it and shading it in over and over until the book feels complete.
So Andre, can we talk about Andre?
Yeah, we can talk about Andre.
Is he on the table?
Look at you. Yes, we can talk about Andre.
There is a second male character in the book. His name is?
Andre,
yeah. In the beginning, he's just sort of an outside character, but you see him slowly, and I don't think he's manipulating or using the situation at all, but...
It's a love triangle, y'all.
Thank you for that.
Okay, yep. Go ahead.
Did he suddenly appear, or was...
Oh, no, I knew Andre all along. I knew from the beginning that Celestial would have a lover. And I did wrestle, though, with who it should be, because I feel that she's in such a situation where her life and her desires are so policed by the other characters, but also by society. And I thought, okay, because sometimes people say, of all the people, why did it have to be Andre?
Now, but who says that?
People. I've been on tour since February 6th, people. but what I think is this, I really feel there is no right lover for her to have. If it was a new person, people would say, who is this stranger who walked up in here and disrupted this existing thing? And then it's Andre, and they say, who is Andre? He's been here all along. Because I feel there is no right way. There is no right way for a woman to choose herself, particularly when her husband has such trauma. And so it was really, and I got frustrated because I felt like the boy next door is a perfectly acceptable romantic trope. The entire genre of rom-coms is about the boy next, that's why they have boys next door. But for Celestial, everything, the Roy's incarceration tilts everything where the rules don't apply to her. Like one of the things I was looking at when I was rewriting it is that I was reading other novels about marriage. And I noticed that a lot of novels about marriage where the question is whether or not a woman is fulfilled by her marriage, almost always they're novels about middle class or upper middle class white women. And they are unfulfilled in their marriage. And when you read it and they leave the marriage, you feel like, yes, you know, get free, live your life. And I was like, why are there not novels like this about black women? There are novels about black women in marriage, but usually if she's leaving the marriage, it's because the marriage is violent. Mm-hmm. Like she's running for her life, not just running for her freedom. And I realized that the reason it's easier to root for the women in the novels by the white women is that the man is not in trouble. There's no sense that her leaving will have kind of far-reaching consequences for him in that way, where when she chooses herself, there's no crime in it. And this novel is intersectional, where there's more than one thing happening. That so Celestial is a woman who wants her life and career, much like I want my life and career, like I'm sure many of you want your lives and career. But the experience of Roy makes this basic desire almost criminal for her.
Like she is so conflicted in the end, and I think that gives so much power to the story.
You know, when I first wrote it, she wasn't that conflicted, but then I was in the grocery store around the corner from my house, and I ran into this guy. I had only gone out like on 4 dates with him, and I ran into him over there by the rotisserie chickens. You know the rotisserie chickens?
Yeah.
And he was over there buying a rotisserie, looking sad, buying a rotisserie chicken, like, you left me. You only went out on 4 dates with me. Now I have to eat a rotisserie chicken. He looked so sad. And for a minute, I was like, oh no, I've caused this man to have to eat a rotisserie chicken. And he wasn't even my wrongfully incarcerated husband, you know? And so I realized that if this man just dolefully reaching for the rotisserie chicken caused me to feel a moment of conflict, then of course, in this novel, Celestial will be deeply conflicted.
I'm speechless. Um, part of this is about the South. Part of this is about a certain amount of entitlement with some of these characters. There is a sort of social struggle. Roy seems a little bit entitled in the beginning. He's sort of a women's man.
Well, it is a novel about the South. I grew up in Atlanta, and I wrote my first novel about growing up in Atlanta during the child murders. And your first novel is very often your obvious story, right? Like, I grew up in this time. Two children in my class were killed by a serial killer in the late 80s, I mean the early 80s. And so I wrote about that. But then as I left the South, I became more self-consciously a Southern writer because I realized how much people don't understand the South. Like, I live in Brooklyn. I tell people I'm from Georgia. They act like I got up here on the Underground Railroad. They're like, are you all right? How are your parents? Are they okay? And so I really started writing the urban South as I know it. And this is a novel about the South. And Roy is from one small town in the South, and he moves to Atlanta, much like my father was from a small town in Louisiana. And he didn't migrate north. He migrated to Atlanta because Atlanta was seen as the promised land for, for Black Americans. And I really wanted to write about that kind of journey. But I also am very interested in class. You know, I've read articles that say most Americans don't know anyone from another social class. But I think that particularly for Black Americans, because of all the advances of the civil rights movement, like I said, my daddy picked cotton as a boy, but he ended up getting a PhD. So that's an incredible class leap for one generation. I have 43 first cousins. So I have relatives who are from various class backgrounds, and they're my cousins. So there's a lot more discourse, a lot more back and forth. And I was interested in looking at the way that affects people's personal relationships.
So it's interesting because the book in many ways is universal. Marriage, relationships, and fiction is always filled with problems. You know, if it was a marriage where you had, or if they had had, if Roy and Celestial had the perfect marriage, as Roy sort of lays out in the first chapter we were talking about is sort of a little bit boring because it's, I'm sorry. Because it's
pardon,
the perfect
sir?
Setup. You know, here is Roy, who is a ladies' man. He's a graduate of
Morehouse College. Which but I do think that happy marriages are only interesting to the people in them.
Well, that's... And they do nothing for fiction, right? I mean, our job is to get people in trouble.
Well, while I say this, I do think it was important to me that they not have a perfect or happy... I think they were enjoying themselves, but not a perfect marriage because I wanted to avoid, do y'all watch Dateline? Dateline undermines my faith in humanity. You know, it always starts off, they were the perfect couple. And then, and I wanted to avoid that trope, but also I wanted to avoid the idea that, because I knew from the start that Roy was going to be wrongfully incarcerated. And I did not want to try to make him earn our sympathy by being exemplary. Like, I didn't want to employ respectability to make him a worthy victim. He is worthy of our sympathy because he's a human being to whom something has happened.
Awful happened, yeah. So where were we going with this?
You were telling me my book was boring, and then I was, and then I was like trying not to be offended because we're on stage. How about I read?
That would be good.
Okay, I'm going to read.
Do I get to pick or do you?
No, I get to pick. I'm going to read a little bit from the day that Roy is arrested, and then I'll read his first letter to her. And this is from Celestial's point of view. What I know is this. They didn't believe me. 12 people, and not one of them took me at my word. There in the front of the room, I explained that Roy couldn't have raped the woman in room 206 because we had been together. I told them about the magic fingers that wouldn't work, about the movie that played on the snowy television. The prosecutor asked me what we had been fighting about. Rattled, I looked to Roy and to both our mothers. Banks objected, so I didn't have to answer, but the pause made it appear that I was concealing something rotten at the pit of our very young marriage. Even before I stepped down from the witness stand, I knew that I had failed him. Maybe I wasn't appealing enough, not dramatic enough, too not from around here. Who knows? Uncle Banks, coaching me, had said, now is not the time to be articulate. Now is the time to give it up. No filter, all heart. No matter what you're asked, what you want the jury to see is why you married him. I tried, but I didn't know how to be anything other than well-spoken in front of strangers. I wish I could have brought a selection of my art, the Man Moving series, all images of Roy. I would say, this is who he is to me. Isn't he beautiful? Isn't he gentle? But all I had were words, which are light and flimsy as air. As I took my seat, not even the black lady juror would look at me. It turns out that I watched too much television. I was expecting a scientist to come and testify about DNA. I was waiting for a pair of handsome detectives to burst into the courtroom at the last minute, whispering something urgent. Everyone would see that this was a big mistake, a major misunderstanding. We would all be shaken but appeased. I fully believed that I would leave the courtroom with my husband beside me. Secure in our home, we would tell people how no black man is really safe in America. But 12 years is what they gave him. We would be 43 when he was released. Roy understood that 12 years was an eternity because he sobbed right there at the defendant's table. His knees gave way and he fell into his chair. The judge paused and demanded that Roy bear this news on his feet. He stood again and cried, not like a baby, but in a way that only a grown man can cry, from the bottom of his feet, up through his torso, and finally through his lips. When a man wails like that, you know it's all the tears he was never allowed to shed, from Little League disappointment to teenage heartbreak, all the way up to whatever injured his spirit just last year. As Roy howled, my fingers kept worrying a rough patch of skin beneath my chin, a souvenir of scar tissue. When they did what I remember as kicking in the door, what everyone else remembers as opening it with the key, after the door was open, however it was opened, we were both pulled from the bed. They dragged Roy into the parking lot, and I followed, lunging for him, wearing nothing but the white slip. Someone pushed me to the ground, and my chin hit the pavement. My slip rode up, showing everything to everyone, and my tooth sank into the soft skin of my bottom lip. Roy was on the asphalt beside me, barely beyond my grasp, speaking words that didn't reach my ears. I don't know how long we lay there, parallel like burial plots. Husband, wife, what God has brought together, let no man tear asunder.
Wow.
There we are.
That was Tayari Jones talking with Aaron Stander. Tayari Jones' latest book is An American Marriage. Support for the National Writers Series comes from Jonathan and Marissa Wege, supporting good things that need to happen now. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org and listen to past programs at interlockinpublicradio.org. For Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Linnea Melcarrick.